Welcome to Nashville to Memphis, a podcast hosted by Dr. Jason Lee McKinney, a recording artist, songwriter, and the rock star professor. N2M is a podcast where Jason and a guest or two literally talk on the phone while Jason is driving down I-40. The only subject criteria is that this podcast is all about the random crap Jason thinks about. So, all of you podcasting and audiophiles, just chill on the sound quality, you dig? Jason is a front pocket theologian, back pocket socio-philosopher, and a jockstrap surveyor of the music industry. You may not be able to make sense of it all, but that's okay. Neither can he. Thanks for listening to Nashville to Memphis. Don't forget to rate and write a review for the podcast on iTunes. You can find it under the title Nashville to Memphis. You can reach the podcast at www.facebook.com/Nashville to Memphis. And check out Jason's music at www.jasonleemckinneyband.com, as well as iTunes and Spotify under Jason Lee McKinney Band.
When looking for the girl with the green eyes, you know what old Jack Burton says. This episode of N2M, I have the pleasure of syncing up with Cole Ebel, Vice Chair of the Libertarian Party of Tennessee. In addition to his role in the party, Cole also owns Ebel's Tavern in Carthage, Tennessee. Cole has a background in broadcast journalism and his journey to becoming a libertarian. We talk about that, standing on principle, even within the party, the wasted vote, and why people are stuck in the two-party mentality. So sit back, buckle up, and adjust the rear view. The exits for 440 and Bell Road are just ahead on this week's episode of Nashville to Memphis.
Start out a little light. I did see that you went to Davidson Academy.
I did.
My twin sons went to Ezel, and man, we used to kick Davidson's butt in basketball.
Good. I hated that school.
Yeah, we played Davidson a lot, man.
Yeah, Davidson was it's a private school that claims they act like they're Harvard or something, and really what it is it's all the kids that get kicked out of every other school got thrown in this one private school. So.
Yeah, my experience with Ezel was a great academic education for my children, but the school was either filled with, if I may be so bold, either really rich, spoiled white kids, or inner city kids who were very athletic, or people who got kicked out of another school. Like, those are the three dynamics that you got.
That's exactly right.
And so it was like, well, this is not really real world. This is not really what you're going to experience in life on any level. So,
I keep in pretty much every single person I hung out with at that school, every single one of them has some kind of criminal record now.
Wow.
Like a pretty major criminal record. And, I ended up graduating from public school. It's funny, I'm saying this as a libertarian, but, and I didn't really learn much. I just had to, my whole point was just to graduate. And,
right.
I went into public school thinking, I'm going to have to fight every freaking day. And cause I fought so much at Davidson. And it was just like peace and love, man. It was like, great. I was like, oh, this is great. This is how school should be.
Right.
I thought I was at a peaceful school.
Right. It's funny. Ezel, last thing on this, but my sons were on the basketball team, obviously, and they were one of them was really good. But it's funny because you'd see the basketball players the year or two after they graduated, and Ezel's Church of Christ, they would all come in with really long hair and beards. It's like they had spent many years being told you got to keep your hair this length. That as soon as they got out, they're like, I'm growing a beard. I'm growing my hair out. It's just a part of just exerting that freedom of like, man, I'm so tired of being under this thumb, that I'm ready to explore the world a little bit. So, hey, first real question. So, and I know this is probably a little bit like on the cheesy side, but just talk to me a little bit about your journey. Like, how did you end up coming to your revelation or evolution to libertarian beliefs? Because I don't think most people grew up in a libertarian home. I think it's still probably growing enough that I don't think a lot of people did. So how did you get involved and how did you become a libertarian?
Absolutely. So basically what had happened for me was for years I was a part of the Republican Party. Actually, I was never a registered. I was always an independent, but I considered myself a Republican from the idea of what I thought a Republican should be, because that's what I was taught. I was taught, these are Republican values, this, that, the other. But to be honest with you, I never saw Republicans using those values that I was taught. And I was just kind of like, okay, so that's our values, but we don't do it. I don't really understand, whatever. So, basically with every major change in people's political philosophy, you know, things build up and, you know, it's basically, you know, I like to relate it to, you know, a weapon and, you know, a weapon without, it has multiple parts of the weapon. You know, you have the firing pin, you have the, you know, you have the powder, you have the bullet. And, basically that firing pin for me that struck the bullet to was in 2013, they had this kind of disagreement between Republicans and Democrats where they decided to shut down our memorials down in DC. And so, that pretty much set me off pretty well. But then it was the following week I found out, that they started denying our veterans death benefits, death gratuities, which is something that veterans actually pay into. And oh, wow. We're in a time of war. And basically that just set me off. And I said, you know, to hell with this government. It doesn't work. I'm tired of it. And me and a few of my veteran buddies went up to D.C. and we thought that we'd be by ourselves. We didn't plan anything with anyone. And we decided that we were just going to go take as many barricades down as possible until we got arrested. And we decided we'd fight whatever we had to fight, you know, but we weren't going to stand for it anymore. And so what we did after that is we went up there and we ended up finding out there's a lot of other veterans doing that same deal. And then the Tea Party came in, obviously, and they tried to hijack it. And so we would start leading. We'd start leading elsewhere. We'd move locations. And the Republican Party or the Tea Party faction of it would follow us. And and basically with five guys, we led this whole event. And so we all said, well, to hell with this. We need to write our own political philosophy. Now, granted, I'd heard of a libertarian before. I had no idea what a libertarian was. The way my perception of a libertarian was a bunch of pot smoking hippies. That's what I thought libertarians were. And I was like, well, I'm definitely not one of those. And not that anything's wrong with it. I just wasn't one of those kind of people. And I began to write my own political philosophy. And I showed it to a couple people. And they said, hey, that's pretty much lines up with what a libertarian is. I said, no. So I'm not one of those guys. And then I had another person tell me that. So I had to go out and look at the platform and read it all. And it was almost exactly the same platform that I had written with inspiration from just tyranny. And so I said, well, this is my party. I didn't know it existed, but now that I do, I'm going to own it. And I started getting involved that way. And so that's how I came to libertarianism. And it was ultimately through the tyranny of our federal government.
Right. Awesome, man. So, and then you ended up working on the Johnson campaign, right? Did I read that correctly?
Yes. So I worked on the Johnson campaign last year. I actually was a delegate for the state of Tennessee down in Orlando when we put up Johnson and Weld. Johnson really won me over because he was the only one that was sincere with me, the only one that sat down and took time to talk with me about concerns that I had. And literally the only reason I voted for Weld in any way was because Johnson begged me to, because Johnson had my vote. I did not want to vote for Weld, and that was the only reason. And I actually ended up heavily regretting that down the road that I did vote for Weld. But I was able to rectify that for a lot of us in the state. We had a campaign. I don't know if you remember the Rachel Maddow situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so when that happened, we all decided, you know, it's time to stand up for that. We don't endorse Hillary Clinton. So we got to call him out on the spot down in Memphis I think it was November. It was right before the election. So that was a pretty cool moment, you know, where we were able to stand on principle. And right. We didn't have to call Johnson out. We called Weld out because we still loved Gary Johnson. And, you know, not everybody thought he was the greatest candidate, but in my mind, I thought he was the best. He stood the best chance, and I feel like he spread the movement quite a bit for a lot of libertarians.
Right. Well, I can tell you this. My wife and I voted for him. And what do you say to – because the thing we got back, and I'm sure this meant it's cliche, but, like, you're wasting your vote. And you, two things. You're wasting your vote, and by voting for a third party,
you put, I put Trump in the office because I didn't vote for Hillary. Or if Hillary would have won, I put Hillary in office because I didn't vote for, like, how do you, where I try to state the argument of, I voted for who I thought the best candidate was, regardless of how, because people say, well, you knew he wasn't going to win. That's not why I vote. I vote for the person I think would do the best job in the office, but you're obviously way more involved than me. How do you answer that question without, I don't think people mean bad. I don't think they're trying to, you know, piss you off or be mean, but it's just like, okay, I am voting consciously for who I think the best candidate is. That's the only responsibility I have.
My straight up answer is I don't vote based on how other people vote. I vote for who I feel deserves my vote. I fought really hard for, well, you know, down the road, but I feel like I fought really hard for my country, and my vote counts more, you know, just as much as anybody else's. And my vote is not wasted. And if it's me, the only person voting for one person and nobody else votes for it, that vote counts extraordinarily. That's a huge vote. And I'm not going to base my vote on probabilities of polls or what other people think or anything relatively based on that. I'm going to vote my conscience. And 70,000 Tennesseans did that this past year. They decided, you know, we're going to vote our conscience. We're tired of this two-party system. And they went to the ballot box, and they stated so.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I think, like I said earlier, that more people, far more people actually believe in libertarian principles than they realize. But for some reason, people seem to be stuck in this sort of false dichotomy of either or, but at the same time are incredibly disillusioned with the two-party system. So what do you think is it going to take in the future, primarily answer like in Tennessee and then on a national level, for like libertarianism to break through to sort of the mainstream consciousness of the American voter as an alternative that they will actually consider? Because the thing I look at is this is not the first time in this country that a quote-unquote third party has risen up and become one of the major parties. It has happened before. So what do you think those steps are? What's it going to take for that to happen in Tennessee and then on the national level?
Well, I mean, first you have to go ahead and realize and accept that there is a stigma that has been attached to every American's brain. And what has happened is over the years, Americans have just accepted, and they accept this, that you can vote for the lesser of two evils. And they've accepted the fact that you can vote for evil as long as it's not as evil. And this has been brainwashed, whether through mass media or through Hollywood or through just everyday conversations, but it has been brainwashed into the American culture. And so the only reason they're not going to vote for it is viability. When they start, either they're going to have to come to a realization, as many of us did, and have that that firing pin hit and say, you know what, to hell with this, or they're going to have to see viability. And right now, the way the Republicans and Democrats play against each other, play with each other, as you would say, is they put that out there so that you're not viable. You're a radical if you vote for a third party. Third parties are not viable. That's what they want you to think. And isn't that sad that in our system, in our republic, or what was a republic, which is definitely not now, it's not even close to a democracy now, is that they suppress any other option besides two options that have been in power, and it's authoritarianism. And so to answer your question is, what's it going to take? It's going to take viability. Now, are we going to continue the same strategy? And all I can do is speak for the state. I can't speak for the nation, but I can speak on behalf of the state party. To have viability, most strategists in the past have gone and they've said, you know, we've got to win a big office. If we win a big office, we can go down. We can get more people and say it's viable. And our strategy is actually probably the opposite of all other 49 states. We're going to go from the bottom up. We're going to start working on county commission seats, city commission seats. We're going to get training in those areas. We're going to show people libertarianism in action, how it works, and show, hey, this works. And then we can start building from there and say, you know what? You know, we start taking over our county. We start showing us, say, let's start running someone for a state house.
Right.
You get two or three people in there. New Hampshire's just already has three people in their house. You put those in there and then maybe start running for state senate and start growing from there. But the focus is, I forget which proverb it is, but it's a man who plants a seed knowing that he won't sit under that tree's shade is where you have a future for your country. And I might not be quoting that correctly, but that's what we're trying to do here. You know, I might not see a libertarian government in my lifetime, but I'm not going to sit there and say, well, because I won't see it, I'm not going to do anything about it. I want my kids to be able to see it. That's what I'm fighting for.
That's interesting, because, you know, that's, and I'm not trying to speak hyperbolically here, but that's kind of what the founding fathers did. If you think about it, they were older than us, and mm-hmm. they thought they would probably never see the country come to really fruition the way that they dreamed it would be, but they did it anyway because it was right.
Well, to be honest with you, as much studying as I've done on our founding fathers, and basically what our founding fathers were, what they did is they put it on paper. That's all they really did. It was a people's movement, and the people led the revolution, and the founding fathers followed. But all said and done, most of the people who were leading and who were following and who were the founding fathers, I'm 32 years old, and a lot of them were younger than me or about my age. There were a few founding fathers that were actually I'd say in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And so that's basically inspiration for me and a lot of people in this movement. I mean, I would say, and I'm not trying to have a generational divide, because obviously we have a lot of different generations in our party, but in Tennessee, I can definitely tell you that it's led by the younger generations. It's led by those that are saying, you know what, we're not going to continue what our parents' mistakes and our grandparents' mistakes are. We're going to start something new here and have that spirit that our founding fathers and the founding people had in this country.
Thank you so much for listening to Nashville to Memphis. I hope you enjoy it. I truly value your time and appreciate your listenership. Please go on iTunes and give us a rating. 5 stars helps. It goes a long way. Write a sentence or two. In addition to that, if you wouldn't mind, I love doing this podcast. It is definitely a passion play for me. But like everything else in life, it does cost a little bit of money. So if you would, go to Spotify and follow the Jason Lee McKinney Band. Give us a stream or two and put us on your playlist. And then also go into iTunes and download a song or two. We have 5 albums out. And it truly goes a long way. Every download counts. Every single one. Share us with your friends. Check it out. Support the podcast. Support the band. JasonLeeMcKinneyBand.com. Spread it around to all your friends, neighbors, and fans. Yourself. And I truly appreciate listening to Nashville to Memphis. Back to the show.
Awesome. So, okay, for somebody, let's pretend like somebody doesn't know anything about libertarianism other than what they've read in the very little blurbs on. So can you explain the principle of non-aggression, that whole principle where law, can you just give like a elevator speech on that?
I'll just give you a quick sentence. If you're not infringing on anyone's liberty, your liberty should not be infringed upon, period. Expand. If you want to expand into that in any kind of situation, any kind of government policy, whether you're, you know, the left's, their arguments are, you know, probably healthcare or marriage, or the right,
right.
Probably, you know, terrorism or, you know, Second Amendment. I mean, in any way, you can basically go and put that argument forward and say, you know, is my liberty being infringed upon?
Right.
Or am I infringing on someone else's liberty? And if my liberty is being infringed upon without me infringing on someone else's, that's unjust. And
right.
And it's force, and it's force is not good. Force is radical. We are not a radical party. We're actually the most moderate party, because we don't believe
right.
in force. We're actually the party that believes in humanity. We're the only party that believes in humanity, believes that people are sovereign, that people are humans, and people will do good for the most part. Is there people that will not do good? Absolutely. We're not naive to that fact. But at the time that happens, there's a consequence. Preventative law does not work. Prohibition does not work. It never has worked. And it, and to continue doing it over and over is a definition of insanity,
right.
expecting a different result.
Now that leads to, I mean, one question I have, and one that I've actually, like I said, I'm fairly new to libertarianism, and I really do, I want to get more involved, and I may have a side conversation non-podcast with you about how to do that, if you're open to that.
Absolutely.
But, this legislation, and I don't know a lot about it, about the whole pornography thing that was voted on. the thing I struggle with as a parent is just my kids, like not being old enough to handle it. How do you as a parent control them not getting to it? That whole thing. As an adult, I'm totally, you know, I mean, my wife is a marriage counselor, so I could go into all the effects that she would say psychologically it can have, but I think adults ought to have the freedom to do it. My concern comes with children. Where do you fall on that in the vote and that sort of thing? And I'm not asking antagonistically at all. I'm asking.
Oh no, absolutely. And I'm fine if you did too. It's okay. But no, you're absolutely right. You know, children are different because, children until they're of legal age, they fall under you. They fall under the adult's liberties, and technically they don't have liberties until they're at that consenting age, which right now in this country is either 18, 21, or 25, whatever they want to put it at for whatever legal.
Whatever very inconsistent with that. Insurance is 25, alcohol is 21, and military.
Yeah, 18, so we'll put it at 18, okay? So the beautiful thing is we have technology to protect our children from things like that. We want them to be safe. People who are advocating against this pornography bill aren't necessarily pro pornography. Probably, I'd say the most of them are probably anti pornography. They're against this bill because of the precedent that it sets. It sets a precedent, you know, let's define pornography. You know, what could be art to someone could be pornography to someone else, and very easily just, and go to some of your statues downtown Nashville. They could be considered pornographic. And so we have the technology to shield our children from that, but also we have the ability to teach them. Now, I always hear the argument, well, what if they're in a bad family? What do you consider a bad family? You know, right. I've seen some awful families. I've seen families where there's been a kid hanging around with parents and there's meth needles and on the counter, and the kid's just playing in that environment. And it's terrible. It's sad. And, you know, at that time, I do feel, you know, there are, you know, infringements on liberty. And do I know the answer for that? No, I don't. I do believe that, you know, you need to be proven guilty in a court of law. But it should be up to the parents. It should not be the government stepping in the parents' lanes as far as how they should be, how children should be raised. And I feel like the less government you have in any situation, eventually some people are going to go through some hard times as kids or some good times as kids. But when they do, if they do make it to a consensual age, sometimes they might not even make it to that. But if they do, they will have influences. They will have other influences. And we would hope that they would have good influences as opposed to government influences. And that's basically where we stand.
Yeah. And that kind of leads perfectly to, you know, there are certain things I wish my liberal friends and my Republican friends would understand is that, and I'm speaking for me now, so you can totally correct me if I'm wrong, but I wish my Republican friends realized that you can't, or not can't, can't is wrong, you shouldn't legislate morality because you end up, the legislation you make today can be used against you tomorrow. You infringing upon someone's freedoms legally can be flipped around on you in a very quick moment. And then when you're no longer the popular opinion, then your freedoms can be taken away. And I don't know if my Republican friends understand that you can think something that someone does is morally wrong. That is fine. That is, I have things that I think people do are wrong. I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to drive 95 in a school zone, but I know people that do it. But
there's a quote by Immanuel Kant. He's a Russian philosopher, or Prussian philosopher and geographer. And it's in law, a man is guilty when he violates the rights of others. In ethics, he is guilty if he only thinks of doing so. So there is a difference between.
Correct. Yeah.
And you can have your difference of opinion and feel like as a libertarian, you can be completely ethically against gay marriage. You can be against it, but you just can't force other people to believe in your
correct
ethics.
Yeah.
Because there's people say, well, what about murder? Okay, well, is there an infringement of liberty on murder in murder? Yes. Is there infringement of liberty in gay marriage? No, unless someone's being forced to, you know, and so it's, again, there's just so many hypocrisies. I mean, you look at the hypocrisies on the right are, you know, they'll say, well, we want the government to regulate pornography, but stay away from our schools and our textbooks. We don't, you know, we should, as parents, be able to teach our kids. And they're right on the second one. They're not right on the first one. Then you look at the left where they're like, you know, we should be supporting gay marriage and consensual. I mean, you know, it's two consenting adults, but then they'll go out and, you know, they'll support countries and just funnel money to them where there's forced marriages, where there's, you know, there's little 11-year-old girls being married off to sheiks and other people and dowries are paid, and they support that. And that's slavery. You know, that's
right.
And so there's hypocrisy on both sides, huge hypocrisy. And never have I heard one of them defend it in any way. And it always comes down to what we spoke about earlier, humanity. And the answer on both sides, they have the same exact answer. When you boil down your entire argument, the same exact answer every time is, well, people just can't make those decisions. And it's a lack of faith of humanity. That's all it is. So somebody else should make that decision for them.
Yeah, that hit the nail on the head. That's where I was going with that. And, you know, it's just the bigger government is, like, you know, because I often hear my liberal friends say the lack of caring and the lack of caring for the poor. But when you sort of try to filter giving through legislative programs, the government's inevitably going to take such a huge chunk of that. That it's much less effective than if they would just allow people and giving organizations to give. It just doesn't work. The more red tape, the more it gets screwed up, the less people actually benefit from it.
And, well, I argue with them when they say, well, you're heartless, you don't want this. And the thing is I'm absolutely the opposite of heartless. I love people. I want to help people. But I have a completely different philosophy. I don't believe in giving fish away. I believe in teaching fish. That's what I believe in.
Right.
And I do believe there are times when people aren't able to fish. And in those times, I do believe in consenting, you know, us taking care of each other, allowing us to be human and take care of those who can't, but also not setting things up so that those who can't take care of themselves are just funded and through a system that is a system of slavery, which is pretty much our welfare system as is. And it's not because I'm heartless. There are people who do need that who do need that income, and they wouldn't get it from the church as of now. And no, libertarianism cannot happen overnight. You're going to have to wean people off of this. It's and the whole deal is it's just like when they freed all the slaves. Instead of basically having this program to not to say, you know, obviously they needed to be freed right away, obviously, but there was no education. There was nothing to help people wean them off of that system. And so what happened out of that was prohibition laws, which was in a lot of ways worse than slavery. I mean, there's worse things in slavery. There's worse things in prohibition laws, just depending on the situation. But it was, I mean, we didn't get rid of, I mean, to be honest with you, in my opinion, we didn't get rid of slavery until you know, the Civil Rights Acts, until people stood up to government. And what the government, and I'm sorry if I'm cutting into another area, but I'll speak on civil rights. What the government will have you believe is civil rights was a racial issue. And really what it was not a racial issue. Those were government laws that excluded people. It was a people's issue. What happened, it wasn't black versus white. It was white and black versus government. That was the civil rights movement. There were a lot of white people, a lot of black people that sacrificed a lot in that area to fight government. They weren't fighting white people, and white people weren't fighting black people. It was government fighting and dividing, and they could not divide the people anymore. And that's what happened. So again, back to having a heart and giving to people and helping people. We have a heart. We believe in humanity, and we feel like the welfare system does not help anyone. We feel it kills people more than anything.
Right. All right. So libertarian view on military. I know that Johnson had a lot of military support. And so two questions on that. What is the libertarian view on interventionism with the military?
And the reason Johnson had such support is because he spoke for a lot of the troops that cannot speak for themselves. I'll tell you from being a veteran myself is when you're in the military, you can't ask questions. You give up that right. You give up your rights as citizens. You fall under UCMJ law. So if you speak out, you can literally be arrested for it. A lot of people don't know that. So, well, if the troops want this, why don't they speak up? Because they can't. They literally cannot. And so the way that the Libertarian Party stands is we do stand for a strong national defense with a capital D, defense. If we are attacked, we have the right to retaliate, but only if attacked. We do not have the right to go intervene. You look at the situation in Syria, we don't intervene. That's not our business. Can we condemn diplomatically? Absolutely. You know, we can say we don't stand for this. This is tyranny. But as far as using our military for it, no. If people privately want to go support, you know, whoever they want to go support in that joke of whatever that war is over there, they should be able to do so. But they shouldn't go and abuse our military veterans and treat them like mercenaries, because they're not. They signed up to fight for liberty. They didn't sign up to be mercenaries. If they want to sign up for being mercenaries, there's plenty of companies out there that can do that, but not our military.
So that's great. That explains that very concisely. That's awesome. I have heard people, and this question I've actually heard from other people saying, libertarian, that's just anarchy. You guys believe in anarchy. And so explain to somebody, and I've tried to articulate it, but I think you could do a better job. Explain to people the difference, because they talk about sovereignty of state versus federal. So where's libertarian on sovereignty of state and the whole accusation of being anarchy?
I'm a huge advocate of the 10th Amendment, it's definitely, I mean, there are anarchists in our party, but I mean, it's an idea in the party. And so it's not run by anarchists. The 10th Amendment states that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So anything that's not in your state or your federal constitution, that's left up to the people. So as libertarians, we believe in small government, localized government, and we believe in a ground up system that's saying most of your power is in your local community. That's where we believe the power should be. The ultimate power is in the people. And so if it's not in your local community, your state, or your federal, it's to the people. Don't infringe on people's liberties. It's that simple. And so, you know, if a community gets together and they decide that, hey, we want to have some kind of a sign ordinance, you know, and they all consent to that, you know, obviously I don't care for it, but if the community consented to do this in a localized standard, and, you know, that's going to be beneficial. But let's just say that it's beneficial for one community, might not be beneficial for another community. And so as libertarians, we stand as small localized government. We believe in the least amount of government possible. But no, we are not anarchists. And anarchism has a negative connotation to it. A lot of people think anarchists, they think of a person dressed in black, spray painting an A somewhere and, causing destruction and, you know, like Mad Max or whatever that movie is. And that's not what anarchism is. Anarchism is technically voluntarism. But to me, what it is it's almost an unattainable idea. I mean, if you look at the intentions of communism, and communism in its purest form is actually sounds great. I mean, everybody's happy all the time. Everybody gets plenty of food. Everybody gets plenty of rest. Everybody gets, you know, work play. But it's just not practical. It would never work because we have an element in there called humans. Same with anarchism. In my opinion, now not everybody shares his opinion, so I'm speaking on my personal opinion, I think it's a utopia to have anarchism. I don't think it would work. You have a human element in there where you're going to have to have each other. I feel like as people, we're drawn to each other. We're not meant to be isolationists. And libertarians are not isolationists. We're non-interventionalists. We're very different from isolationists. We believe in community. We believe in reaching out to others and working with each other, but we don't believe in isolationism. So I would say that anarchism is some sort of a form of it. But again, I don't want to speak too much on anarchism because I'm not an anarchist. So I don't want to, I don't want to give, you know, I don't want to say anything negative about them that,
right.
that I can't speak from experience because I'm not one. So gotcha. I will tell you this, that a lot of the anarchists I've worked with are some of the greatest people, some of the kindest people and giving people. But I just don't agree with them, but that doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that I'm right and they're wrong, or they're wrong and I'm, you know, or they're right and I'm wrong or whatever. It doesn't mean that. It just means that I don't believe in it.
So I guess the ground up government, the fear that I've heard from a lot of my more liberal friends that I don't necessarily see as bad, but you tell me your opinion on this, is that if it's ground up, then, and if it's sort of more sovereign to the local community and sovereign states, then the laws in Utah could look very different than the laws in New York. You know what I'm saying? We could end up with that, which I don't have a problem with. And you could end up with, you know, private education in one, and you could end up with just very different laws in different states.
Well, it depends where they live. Why would they care if they're judging on that living in Virginia or wherever they might live? You know, I don't care if California wants to be the most socialist, liberal state in the world, and, you know, do whatever they're going to do. I don't care. Let them do it. You know, it doesn't affect me, but don't use your laws. I'll tell you, they use their laws a lot of times to go and force the rest of the country into what they feel is going to be good. Now that happens a lot in the medical industry. I'll tell you that much right now, where a lot of our laws with healthcare that has driven healthcare costs up and socialized medicine so much, have come from California laws. If Tennessee wants to pass a law on something, yeah, I'm going to speak up on that because I live in Tennessee. I'm a Tennessean. So it really shouldn't matter unless you're trying to control someone in another state. If Utah, if they want to practice polygamy, go for it. What is it? How does it bother? How does it affect me? Whether I agree with it or not, how does it affect me? Does it hurt me? Does it negatively hurt me? Am I held responsible to whatever conversation I may have down the road with someone from another country judging my country? Is it worth passing a law for it? No, I don't care what their opinion is. It's not. It doesn't matter. Is infringement of liberty happening to me? No.
Right. That's awesome. All right. So you kind of spoke on this. So this is a kind of wrapping up here. Two more questions that aren't nearly as serious, but it doesn't have to be regarding libertarianism. But if you had like desert island like books, three books you could take with you, what would be the books you would take? They can be for enjoyment, or they can be regarding libertarianism.
I would take the Bible, the 33 Strategies of War, and just for third book here. I'd take FM-2176 Survival from the United States Military.
That would be
Desert Island.
That sounds like a very practical book there. That sounds like the best one right there.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then I got one more question. That's official, and then I might ask you a couple questions that we won't put on the podcast. So, and I do this with every podcast, regardless of who the guest is. So, no pressure, but I always say this is the most important question. Okay. So, everyone has songs that they love that they're just a little bit embarrassed, like they don't really admit in public that they jam out to. So, I ask everyone to name a guilty pleasure song that, like, you only shower and in the car by yourself. That you secretly admit to. I've heard people with Katy Perry. I've heard all kinds of stuff. So what is your guilty pleasure song?
My guilty pleasure song. Let's see here. I'd say Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name of, probably my song on that. So
gotcha, man. Gotcha. That's awesome, man. Great. That wraps the podcast.
Now that Cole and I have found the lost city of Atlanta, go check out his restaurant and buy a beer or two. Also check out etnlp.org.